What are your expectations for what will be delivered, specifically regarding how heavily redacted it might be? Should Congress, the public, be getting the full report, unredacted?
That's a great question. I think the first thing is we want to get as much as we can.
Mm-hmm.
People used to ask Ted Kennedy, say, why did so many Republicans want to work with you? And they really did. He was their favorite Democratic dance partner on legislation. And he'd say, I'm always willing to compromise on policy, not on principle. I think the principle here is we need the truth. That's where we're going. And Thomas Jefferson used to say, if the people know the truth, they won't make a mistake. We need to know the truth. And if we can get that through some reasonable redactions, that's fine. If we can't, then we need to have the actual words of the report. So we'll see what we can get initially. I will say this. I was troubled. I did not support the Barr nomination. I probably would have, except for the fact that he put out a 19-page, single-spaced piece that basically said that the president's almost above the law, mm-hmm. cannot be prosecuted. And I think none of us is above the law, including presidents. So I think he walked into this job believing that presidents pretty much are immune from this kind of investigation and scrutiny. I don't think they are. And Bill Clinton certainly wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think this Richard Nixon certainly wasn't. And I don't think this president is either. So we need to get to the truth. And hopefully we can with appropriate redactions. But if we can't, then we'd like to see the real thing.
Would you be okay with maybe the public not seeing a full report, but maybe Congress getting something that is not redacted or maybe less redacted than?
I think that may be a good compromise, particularly the committees of jurisdiction
mm-hmm.
have the opportunity, especially the Intelligence Committee and the Judiciary Committee have the opportunity to see the full document. I have a friend, Tom, you ask him how he's doing. He says, compared to what? And in the case of this investigation and the release of the findings of the investigation, I say, well, how about Ken Starr? When he was counsel and looking into Whitewater, which started out as a land deal that went bad and turned out to be something entirely different.
Mm-hmm.
But that report was made fully released to the public. And so like compared to what in this instance? Well, compared to the Starr report, which is fully released, I think that sets a pretty good standard.
I do want to change gears here and go to a story that we did recently looking at PFAS contamination on and around military installations like Dover Air Force Base and mm-hmm. the Air Guard Base in Newcastle. As we reported, you've been raising questions with the EPA about a lack of urgency on groundwater cleanup standards and the possible pressure from the Defense Department and others to weaken those standards. I'm curious, since we have some time with you, what are you looking for short-term and long-term to deal with this PFAS contamination issue?
Mm, yeah. The EPA has set a certain standard. I think it's 70 parts per trillion for PFAS, for these permanent chemicals. There's a whole big family of them. And the folks at the Department of Defense, who I don't think get paid for making these sorts of decisions, say, oh, no, like 400 parts per trillion. Anything that's has contamination less than 400 parts per trillion, we don't think that should be cleaned up, really. So we have, I think one of the rights that we ought to have as citizens in this country, I think we ought to have clean air, we have free speech and freedom of religion and all that. But we also ought to be able to know that when we turn on the taps for our water and drink our water, that it's not going to hurt us. And so we have this back and forth. But we fortunately, we have a system of checks and balances. In this case, I think there's some internal debate going on in the Trump administration between the EPA and the folks at DOD. The principle here that we want to stay close to and follow is we want to make sure water's people can drink water and be safe and not have to worry about all kinds of complications with their health.
So, short term, the question is the standard itself. Long term, what can be done then once you settle on that standard? To really work and find mm-hmm. these spots and clean them up.
Well, we have the ability to measure contamination, and some of the contamination has been measured around the country from in some cases military bases where You know, we use certain chemicals to clean airplanes and that sort of thing. But where in some of those places, the concentration of these, what we call them, permanent or forever chemicals, is as much as like a million parts mm-hmm. per trillion. And the standard is, according to the EPA, is 70 parts per trillion. Talking about a million? Really? So I think the idea ought to be we don't have the money in Superfund cleanup to clean up every one of them right away, but I think our goal should be to start with the worst ones and start there and then work our way forward.
I want to move on to a little bit about the border and Central America. President Trump has backed off his threat to close the southern border with Mexico, but he seems deterministic by his plan to cut off aid to the Northern Triangle countries in Central America, Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador. You've joined with a number of other Democratic lawmakers to oppose that move. And this is something you've talked about a fair amount. You were talking about it a lot during the debate over funding the president's border wall. What do you see as the primary dangers of cutting off this aid just like that?
Well, first of all, let me just say very clearly. I for a while, I was the chairman of the Homeland Security Committee in the Senate. I've been on the border many times with Mexico and over toward the California border in Arizona. I was on the Arizona border right there with Mexico with John McCain a time or two. And I think we have invested since 2003 over $250 billion. To make our borders more secure, particularly the border with Mexico. I think if a country doesn't have secure borders, we've got a problem. But it can't all be about addressing the symptom. The symptoms when people try to get into our borders, whether it's for economic reasons or humanitarian reasons or nefarious or criminal reasons. We could have a wall. We could actually have the 2,000-mile wall, 30 feet high. People still try to get here and turn themselves in and ask for asylum. And they live, in many cases, lives of misery. Their lives are made miserable by virtue of our addiction to drugs. So these drugs are trafficked up from Colombia and other places to the south through parts of Honduras, Guatemala, and Salvador, through Mexico. And it's a big business. And if we weren't addicted to drugs, you know, that problem would go away for the people in Honduras, Guatemala, and Salvador. Well, we are unfortunately deeply addicted in many cases. So part of what... and actually, this is the brainchild of Joe Biden. I've been involved in it as well, going back 4 years ago in the last administration. But the idea is create something that has worked before. In Colombia, 20 years ago, the country of Colombia was reeling under the FARC, guerrilla gangs, drug gangs trying to bring down the government of Colombia. One day, a bunch of criminals went into Bogota, the capital, and they took the Supreme Court justices into a room and shot them all to death. And so here's Colombia's reeling, and they reached out and asked if we would help. We did. We said, this is your country. You got to do the heavy lifting. But we did things like provide Apache helicopters to provide mobility for Colombian troops, police to go all over the country in a very rugged terrain and go after the bad guys. We helped them raise revenues. We gave them some money, you know, through foreign aid and stuff, but we helped them raise money within their own countries so that the wealthy people who live there would start paying some taxes. That's how I did it. Now, Colombia's a very successful country. It took a long time. But we've taken that model for what worked in Colombia, and we plunked it down in Honduras, Guatemala, and Salvador about 4 years ago. And the idea is to say, why do all these people want to get out of there, those three countries, and come to our country? Three big reasons. One, the lack of economic hope and opportunity. Two, crime and violence. And three, just so much corruption. It's endemic in those countries. And we've set up initiatives with these three countries. We put up in Salvador, for every dollar we put toward those three causes, they put up $7. We help leverage money from foundations, non-governmental organizations, private corporations, in order to address lack of economic opportunity and hope, address crimes and violence, address corruption. And it's starting to work. But what we need to do is a combination of those things, root causes and stuff that we're focused on through three countries, and to secure our borders. And the other thing is to make it clear to the people in these three countries that if they don't have a legitimate asylum claim, we're not going to forever let them come by the tens of thousands into our countries, get into our country and just like disappear and never go through the immigration process and so forth. That's just not a winning combination. I was on the phone this morning with one of the top officials at Border Patrol, Customs and Border Patrol, and to talk about We had a great hearing before the Homeland Security Committee trying to find out beyond what we're doing in terms of security on the border, beyond what we're doing in the Alliance for Prosperity to work with these three countries on root causes, what else do we need to do? What more do we need to be able to do to stem this tide? But to do so in a way that's compassionate and humane to the folks in those three countries.
I want to talk a little bit about the president's proposed budget. There's been a lot of discussion about that in the past month. Are there some particular pieces that you find worrisome for Delaware and Delawareans?
I'm a senior Democrat now on the Environment and Public Works Committee. The president has called for deep cuts in funding for environmental protection. We have real challenges in this part of the world. We have problems with groundwater quality. In particular, we have one out of six people in our state get their water from wells. And in some of the, particularly in the southern part of the state, the quality of the water that's coming out of those wells is not good. And so the idea of cutting by a third protection, water protection programs across the country, I'm not sure that's consistent with our values or what we'd like to see happen. The president called for last, a year ago, a $1 trillion transportation infrastructure proposal.
Right.
He proposed to use $200 billion, again, $1 trillion infrastructure program, roads, highways, bridges. He proposed to use $200 billion of federal money to leverage the states to do $800 billion. But while he was going to, with one hand, provide $200 billion to the states to leverage an $800 billion investment by the states, he was going to reduce other federal transportation program to the states by $200 billion. So I said at the time, I don't think that's going to work. Well, this time, in the administration's proposal this time, they don't do that. But unfortunately, they don't really have what I think is a workable plan either. But I've met with, actually, believe it or not, the president's daughter, Ivanka Trump, came by my office, brought one of the top folks from the president's leadership team, works on congressional cooperation. And we had actually a really good conversation about what we could do to mount a very highly effective transportation initiative, and so I'm encouraged by that. It's not in the budet, but it's actually the start of a good conversation that I think can lead us to compromise.
I do want to quick hit on something that maybe didn't get a whole lot of attention, maybe the attention it should have gotten. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell moved to cut the bait for lower level agency and judicial nominees from 30 hours to 2 hours, citing Democratic obstruction as his rationale. Can you explain a little bit about what in practice this does to the process and what the ramifications would be, are for doing this?
Yeah. We've, founding fathers who crafted a constitution that was first ratified 5 miles from where we're sitting at this moment here in Dover. But they didn't agree about everything when they were working on the constitution. One of the things they agreed on was they didn't want a king. And they put in place in this Constitution this incredible system of checks and balances. And it's a hard way to govern. And it's not always easy to compromise and develop consensus. It's critical that we do that. But I think in the first 2 years of the Trump administration, I think the Republicans have gotten as many federal judges confirmed in 2 years as in 4 years, first 4 years of the Obama administration. And yet Mitch McConnell and the president say, well, that's not enough. Really? I always say, like, compared to what? Well, it's twice as many judges as were confirmed in the first 4 years of the Obama administration. And the idea of, I think, kind of like a running roughshod over the minority, it may work for a short while, but eventually the Democrats will be, there'll be a Democratic president. There'll be a Democratic majority in the Senate. I say to my Republican friends when they're trying to push this change through, be careful of the bed you make because someday you'll have a chance to sleep in it.
I do want to quickly ask you about former Vice President Joe Biden. As we're awaiting a final decision on his 2020 presidential run, a handful of women have come forward describing instances of unwanted physical encounters with him. He released a video saying he recognizes social norms are changing and promising to be more mindful in respecting personal space going forward. I'm curious, as you've watched this all unfold, you know, what have you been thinking?
For a while, our state motto was, it's good to be first. When I think of Delaware, I think maybe a good motto was friendly, but you'll get used to it. And this is a state where I hug people. I hug women. I hug men. I hug children. I kiss babies. Joe does too. And I think it's accepted here. It's normal behavior, and with the people generally know us, and hopefully most of them like us. But they don't. They wouldn't let us hug them and kiss them. But in any event, in some other places, people don't feel that way, and they don't know us as well. And what might be acceptable behavior might be for some people unappreciated. So I think we just have to be really good. Not just in Delhi, but especially in other places, and be sensitive to how, put ourselves in other people's shoes and say, how would I want to be treated if I'm in their shoes? And Joe, I think he's handled it very well, and he's acknowledged that maybe what is the way we live here in Delaware is just not quite as acceptable in other places, and be more sensitive to that. And he's pledged to do that. And I think he's handled it just great. And I hope that we can go forward. He said he's going to be careful in the future. I'm sure he will be. Maybe I should be too.
Do you think it changes the calculus at all whether or not he's going to run
or what his prospects are? No, not at all. Not at all. I'm hopeful that he's going to run. I think he'd be a great great candidate. I think he can win. I think he can unite our party, but not just our party. I think he can unite our country. And I think he can help return our standing in the world of nations, and we need that.